Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Rahalastapur Book Club. I am delighted to be joined this week by David Baddiel, and he has written a book called The God Desire. Hello, David.
Hello, Richard. You said to me before this started that it was a bit more serious than the normal podcast that you do, which I've been on numerous occasions, which is very funny.
Yes.
But I noticed that you've begun by calling me David Baddiel.
I did, yes.
Which, for anyone who doesn't know, is a running gag, or which Richard Herring does, because yes. His dad insisted on calling me David Baddiel every time I was on telly, much as he used to call Doritos Doritos.
That's correct.
It's good that even as we start talking about, as older men, we sort of said right now it's time to move into more serious subjects. We keep those jokes going. Don't worry.
Absolutely. Well, I don't want to let my younger self down just because I've become older and wiser. So that is good. David, you've written a lot of books. The last one I read was Jews Don't Count, which is a similar format to this book in that it's a shorter book, but taking on quite a big subject.
Yeah.
You've also written, it's a fantastic book. We may talk about it a little bit, you've also very successful children's author.
Yeah.
It seems you get to do whatever you want to do.
I did four adult books as well.
Yes, of course.
I did novels as well. Before I frankly realised something, which is that I was never going to get nominated for the Booker Prize. because they weren't good enough, no doubt, but also because I was that bloke off the telly on that football show.
Yes.
And I think that meant that somehow or other, you're not allowed to write literary grown-up books if you're that person, but you are allowed to write children's books. It's a slightly weird thing. You're sort of allowed to write plays, like Patrick Marber has proved.
He did.
And you're sort of allowed to write children's books, but serious novels, the gatekeepers of culture have a problem with.
You straddle that world a little bit more than some people. You know, you have got quotes from Alan de Botton and
Now I do after many years. But even then, I've gone for non-fiction. I still think if I went back to writing a big old serious literary novel, it would still be dismissed.
Yes.
I'll give you an example, actually. Sorry, this is me just sour grapes now, but it is a book club, so I think I can say this in this context. So I wrote a book called The Secret Purposes, which was my third novel, And it was kind of self-consciously, because my first two novels were not probably, they were more like lad lit, as it was described in the 90s.
Yes.
But the third one was set on the Isle of Man during the Second World War, and it was about the internment of German Jewish refugees on the Isle of Man during the Second World War, something that happened to my grandfather. It was a big, old, proper, serious historical novel. And it was reviewed in the Evening Standard by a bloke whose name I can't remember, which is probably quite good. I can't remember it, rather than like it being seared in my mind. And he gave it a sort of lukewarm review. And then he said, look, this is probably quite a good novel, I suppose. But does David Baddiel really expect us to forget that he's on the telly every Friday night with a beer talking about football? And I'm now supposed to believe that he's like a serious writer writing about this. And I want to say yes. Yes, yeah. It's possible to be both those things. You big flat, whose name I can't remember. But I think that remains a problem for some in the serious literary establishment.
Yeah, it is interesting that, I mean, and it's interesting the way, I mean, I don't actually noted down one of the reviews. It's a good review of The God Desire, but part of it says, despite a good deal of humour, the analysis is razor sharp, as if putting jokes in something is bad. Just initially makes it stupid and wrong. Even though it's funny, it's also correct.
Yeah, that is, I know that's a really funny thing you pointed out. And obviously, let's not downgrade funny, but it's amazing that that is what people think. I mean, The Jews Don't Count has got jokes in it as well.
Yes.
That is in many ways about a more serious subject, really, because whether or not God exists, which is what this book's about, is sort of not a serious subject. I mean, it is a serious subject, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, Jews Don't Count has an actual impact on people's lives. And I think has changed the way that people are talking about an actual form of racism that affects people. And that's really important. Doesn't mean I'm not going to put jokes in it.
No.
Because jokes really, like, are great. And they also help people understand.
Yeah.
They help people understand, oh, right, so I understand this because I've also enjoyed laughing at it, which means that I can read it in a way that I might not read a big old serious tome about the same subject.
Yes. But, no, yeah. I think that's absolutely true. I mean, there are a few comedians doing serious subjects, and we've had a few of them on here, and I think exactly that. And I really like this sort of short form look at a subject dealt with precision and quickly. I wrote The Problem with Men, which was about my International Men's Day, but also about toxic masculinity, and it was a very good exercise, I think, to kind of get that down. I think mine was something like 20,000, 25,000 words to get a subject down into that small amount of time. Is that something that you've relished doing these last two books, to the last two adult books, in terms of kind of getting that precision of argument into a short amount of space?
So well, for anyone who hasn't read either book, they are essay books. You holding it up perhaps makes that clear. And I was asked by the Times Literary Supplement originally to write an essay book, and they specifically said they wanted to reinvigorate a tradition, a kind of Orwellian tradition. Like, so Orwell used to write these books called things like On Language and Politics or whatever, and they would be longer than a news piece but shorter than a proper book, a bit like a pamphlet but a hardback. And I like the idea. I think I quite like it aesthetically. I quite like the look and feel of a short, you know, book. That and obviously I think people do in general, because I've seen quite a lot of art-directed photos of Jews Don't Count in various situations. And so, yeah, I think I like the idea of doing a short book, but something that also is about a big subject but maybe takes a specific element of that subject and drills down into that very specifically. So in this book, The God Desire, which is about atheism, but it's not just about, like, writing a whole book about atheism or the existence of God, which a bad review in the Telegraph seemed to be comparing this book to. There's one point where Tim Stanley in the Telegraph, I do remember his name, says that David Baddiel makes the extraordinary claim that you shouldn't argue for the existence of God using logic and reason, because God is beyond logic and reason. That seems to me to be not an extraordinary claim, but he says, I'd like to see David Baddiel say that too, and then it's a huge list. Thomas Aquinas, René Descartes, Spinoza, Locke, and it goes on forever, basically saying, I've read these people, by the way. That's what Tim Stanley is really saying, I've read these people. But to be clear, it's not like a book that those books would be a comprehensive history of this argument. It's specifically talking about something that I think.
Yes.
Which is that if you ask me why principally I'm an atheist, it's not so much that there's no evidence for the existence of God or that I believe the problem of evil in the world means that there can't be a God. It's because I desperately want there to be a God. I would love there to be a God because I'm a shallow, frightened, desperate person who would love to not be dying quite soon and also would love there to be more meaning to my life than I know there is. And that desperate wish makes me think, if it's shared, which I believe it to be, by an enormous amount of people, that there is a projection, a wish fulfillment that comes from that wish called God. And a lot of people have just bought into that. They've thought, well, I really, really would like that to be the case. I know, we'll just say it is. We'll just say something exists that sorts that out for us. And that's what the book's about. That's why it's called The God Desire.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting premise, and I think it's great because it's, I mean, you debate it yourself and you argue against it a little bit yourself to an extent, but it is that, just that premise is a very good one for debate, because of course you could, just because you don't, you really want something, as you say, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but you say because it's, there's no actual, because it's imaginary, or there's no tangible, you know, like a man in a desert. Yeah. You can want water and not get water, or can get water, but water does exist. We know it exists.
It exists, but an oasis is the thing that appears to a man in the desert desperately wanting water, and that doesn't exist, but the wish is that it should do.
Yeah.
And it's not a straightforward, you know, point-by-point necessarily argument for God's non-existence, the idea that I want it, therefore it can't exist. And I think I quote A.A. Gill, who once said to me, oh, that's so Jewish, I want it so it can't be true, which is an interesting thing, as I say in the book, like, why is that Jewish? And maybe that's just because he's one of those people who I meet quite regularly who just think, oh, he's a Jew, so everything he says must be Jewish in some way. But I do think that it's very much a building block of my general thinking about God and the existence of God, i.e. the actual existence of God as an idea, that the deep, deep desperation of humanity to hope that we do have something more, that we do have a way of defeating death or whatever, has got to be a massive factor in the creation of God.
Yeah.
I mean, it's simply, you know, it's undeniable, isn't it?
I would say so. I mean, I like this book because it isn't polemically atheist in the way that some... It's not dismissive of religion in the same way that can be. It's you know... You're a fan of religion, certainly of the Jewish religion and the Jewish traditions.
I'm a fan of lots of religions, actually.
I don't
know how much it goes across in the book. I certainly, being Jewish, which is a big part of the book, the reason I bring all that in is to say that, I'm not being dismissive of religion, partly because I feel this wish. So the book is written from a very personal point of view, which is I'm not going to dismiss religion, even though I absolutely think God doesn't exist. And by the way, the way that I've come to this thing is exactly the way that a lot of believers come to the same thing. So C.S. Lewis, for example, who's not in the book, I kind of wish he was, because a number of things have been brought to me since writing this book. I thought, oh, I should have put that in. But anyway, Richard Iwadi, who I did an event with the other day, said, oh, have you read C.S. Lewis? And I haven't read loads of people that I should have read before writing this book. C.S. Lewis basically said, well, there are these things that I really desire and that I feel that I need and that are there in the world. They are there in the world. So therefore there must be a God, you know, and John Updike, who I quote, basically says the same thing, which is that in the same way as a child, when they're trying to get to sleep, is reassured by the fact their parents are there. That makes me believe there must be a God, because that same reassurance that we all need makes me feel that it must be there. And that's the same reason why I think there isn't a God. Right, because if we're in need of that reassurance, we've created something to satisfy it. Yeah, but anyway, my point is, in terms of what you were saying, is that yes, I'm not dismissive of religion because I feel the same needs, and I'm not dismissive of religion for another reason, which is as a Jew, I know that it is entwined with identity, that religion is almost always for a minority something to do with their identity, and identity is something that you are, it's in your bones if you are part of a minority. Particularly a minority that has been persecuted nearly out of existence because of the religion and other reasons for many years. So, yeah, that's why I, even though I have a Catholic wife, I spend some time doing Passover and Hanukkah and all the rest of it with my children, because I think that identity is important, even though I don't believe in the supernatural being that we're supposed to be praising. when we do those.
And it's interesting, and it sort of proves your point as well. I think, I mean, you talk about people, you know, whether atheists convert, and some of them do and some of them don't, but people as they get older often move more towards religion as they get closer to death. And even yourself, even though you're not becoming religious, you seem to be very much embracing your Jewishness in a way that you didn't 20 years ago, when you're 30 years ago, when you were in your 20s and having fun in your life, David.
Yes, that's true, Richard, although that might just be to do with getting old. It's also partly to do with increasing anti-Semitism, is the other reason for that. Yes. And a sense that, oh, someone's got to speak about this, and it may as well be me. But yes, I think that's true. I don't know if you feel this. I said this the other day when I was doing the event with Richard, it's a cliche, isn't it? It's a cliche that comedians, as they get older, do a bit less comedy and they get a bit more serious. And it's also a cliche, which I am also falling into, that as you get older, you want to deal with the big questions in life. Yes. You want to examine what are we doing here, you know, and not just do, you know, jokes about Jimmy Hill, basically.
But also I think that's obviously part, but it sort of maybe comes part out of that desire to be taken seriously, which I do and don't have. You know, I sort of think, but I still think being a comedian and being funny is way better than being serious, because it's actually easier to be serious, and it's easy to be
I heartily
sincere.
Agree. Well, I do agree with that completely, and I was always pissed off with certain comedians. Woody Allen was always my main one. That I was pissed off that he seemed to have this rather sort of sixth form belief that because Ingmar Bergman was Ingmar Bergman or whatever, that his silly, funny films weren't very important and he had to try as much as he could to make more and more serious films.
Yeah.
But somehow or other, comedy was not a high art form because, I mean, this is a conversation that I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but because comedy is itself, as an art form, about the inconsequential and about the stupid and about the trivial or whatever, that somehow it's a trivial and inconsequential art form, which obviously it isn't. It's the opposite of that. It's the hardest art form and the most impressive when you get it right. Having said that, I'm never going to completely deny comedy in myself, but two things. One is it's much more of a young man's game, I've realised, as I grow older, particularly live stand-up.
Yeah.
Which I am going to continue to do, but fucking hell, it takes it out of me now, touring and all the rest of it.
Yes, with you.
And it is. I mean, I on the last tour, I thought, I can't do this anymore. I'm going to die. I'm going to be Tommy Cooper. And the other reason is I do genuinely feel that I do have things to say that I will incorporate comedy with, but I can't completely contain within comedy. That neither Jews Don't Count nor this book was something I could do as, a 2-hour stand-up show.
Yeah.
Actually, I did do Jews Don't Count. I've tried it out as a sort of completely ad-lib show. So I went to the Lowry and I did a week where I just came on stage and said, okay, I'm going to talk about this book. Most of you have read it. What do you think? Just like a Q&A, an hour-long Q&A about it, completely ad-lib. And it was 40% funny and 60% serious, which, you know, I completely accept. I'm totally with you about comedy, but I just think there are some things I want to talk about that can't be contained.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I think it's nice to have that light and shade within a comedy show, within a book that's, I mean, this isn't a comedy book. This is a serious book with jokes in it. But funny stuff and funny observations. And like I say, I think it's enough to get the comedy. I got to the end of it and you kind of go, oh, I'd kind of liked a bit more. But what I like about it is, you know, you then start thinking, you know, I think like I thought, you know, I sort of agree with a lot of it, but like if religion is sort of to try and comfort you about death, then why is so much of it really horrible things happening to you after you die? So there's more to it than just that. So they're trying to, they're trying to steer you as well as comfort you.
I actually do deal with that briefly.
Yeah.
In the start of the book where I talk about how the other thing that they're all spin-offs, in my opinion, from death, but it also provides story, it provides meaning, and it provides this word I make up, which is parentness.
Yes.
And I say that, you know, God is basically the supreme parent, and as such, let's call him he, is not just a good parent. He, in a kind of Freudian way, is a good parent and a terrifying parent and a capricious parent and all the things that in the sort of primordial soup of our anxieties and our unconscious, we might project a parent to be. So that's one of the things about desire, is it's not straightforward. Is it, we want something, but once we've projected it, it will turn. It will turn into something that might be great, but might also be nightmarish, which I think God is.
Yeah. And I guess the thing that I mean, I covered a little bit of this sort of subject in Christ on a Bike, which was a much more kind of knockabout look at Christianity, but equally like being impressed. It's the same thing. You know, I grew up as a Christian and I kind of want it to be true. And I like Jesus as an idea, because he's very easy to put your own ideas on as well. But I think, you know, all of us, and it's even those extreme atheists, have made up beliefs or made up moral systems that aren't actually real, that comfort them or get them through life. I mean, I would say, this is a very comforting way of looking at death, is that it's sort of better to have the chance to be alive. You know, when I read this book, I was thinking, you know, dying is horrible. I don't want to die, but I've had the opportunity. Out of all those billions of people who could have existed in my place and in the place of my parents, I've got to experience this. So it's a bit like having an ice cream that's really nice and finishing it and then being annoyed that you got the ice cream, even though
that's quite similar to the thing I quote, which I heard from Arthur Smith, but is in fact a Belgian playwright called Maurice Maeterlinck, which is the living are just the dead on holiday.
Yes, yeah, we'd love that.
There's two ways of looking at that.
Yes.
One is, as you say, which is it's brilliant, you got to be on holiday. You know, what a fantastic thing that you've got to have a holiday. But of course, the tragic thing or the terrifying thing about that is holidays end.
Yes.
Holidays are a short thing. And that. So I find that phrase both cheering and funny and a very, very upsetting.
It is. It's all of those things. But that's what, you know, life is. And I think it is so bleak that if you were absolutely rational and cynical about life all the time, well, or just factual about life at the time.
Yeah.
I think, again, because we get older and things start to go wrong a bit more, and that, you know, you'll have had some tragedy in your life, and you'll have lost people a bit more than when you're young. You know, I think it gets more difficult to put it all together. You know, I have that stuff of kind of lying, you know, you have insomnia, I know as well, which is where a lot of this you claim comes from. Yeah. But, you know, when you're lying in bed in the middle of the night, woken up and you can't get to sleep and you're having sort of dark thoughts that you can't even quite control. Those feel like reality.
Yeah.
And the rest of the time when you're awake and not panicking, feels like you're kidding yourself about life.
That's when you're distracted.
Yeah.
And distraction doesn't feel like reality. Can I just ask, you said, and I knew this about you, but not in any kind of proper way, that you said you were a Christian when you were young.
Yeah.
So until when, and like, how did that work? Who made you a Christian?
My parents were, you know, took us to church a lot, and were members of the community, and you know, and I think still, I think my mum or my dad who's lost it a little bit, but they still go to church. So they took me to church, I had to go for quite a long time, even after I'd lost my faith. And I think I got to about 8 years old and started questioning it.
Right.
And like a few of the things that came up in Christ on a Bike were, you know, just like questioning, the best bit of Christ on a Bike, which was looking at that first page of the New Testament where all the Jesus's descendants are listed, then saying, you know, but and I remember saying to my grandma, but Jesus isn't related to Joseph, so he isn't related to any of these people, her going, and not being able to come up with any answer. And I thought, well, if the first page is wrong, so like, you know, I think just things like that, maybe, you know, and I had that kind of questioning mind, and I didn't like not being able to question it, and we weren't allowed to question it. But I was still, even when I did Christ on the Bike, and I was 33 and I did Christ on the Bike, there was a residual part of me feeling I can't say these things about, even though I think the show was very fair about Jesus. If you watch the whole thing, it's a kind of appreciation of Christ, who I think is better as a man than as a God, because if he's a God, it's sort of meaningless.
You agree with the teachings such as they are.
Yeah.
Obviously we don't even know if they are coherent teachings of anything, but let's assume they are teachings of a man.
Yeah.
That you agree with them, but that once that becomes the teachings of a God, then it becomes a bit silly.
Well, and also the sacrifice is meaningless. It doesn't make, you know, if you're a God and you know that you're going to heaven, if you're not, I mean, you talk about Jesus Christ Superstar in the book, which I think is great, about the way that that kind of is a high art and makes you think about Jesus both as a Messiah and as a rebel. And it's that sort of thing. You know, I don't think that what we have of Jesus is anyway the real guy, but the sacrifice would mean, if you're going to take that central sacrifice, it's meaningless if he knows he's coming back to life again.
So
and, you know, it's kind of interesting that he says, "Oh Father, why hast thou forsaken me?" as he's dying. You go, don't you remember the plan we had about you dying to redeem mankind?
Right. Well, so, as is often the case in the way that I think about God, is I have an argument against that. And I do this quite a lot in the book. In the book, there's a bit where I talk about what is often a big plank in atheism, which is the problem of evil. There's a kind of famous clip of Stephen Fry talking about, you know, why would there be a God when he allows cancer, childhood cancer, and there's all this sort of terrible stuff he talks about.
Yeah.
And I think there's a very straightforward reason for that. If I was a believer, I would just say, well, firstly, God is beyond normal morality. And secondly, of course, there is no good if there's no evil. There's no meaning to good if there's no evil. And I would go a bit further in the book. I say, you know, I would say God is an artist. God is an artist who is creating a massive story in which you need villains and you need terrible things so that extraordinary acts of goodness can happen. That's what I would say.
Yeah, and so but he knows the story. He knows he's doing that, though. So if he's on the cross, he's just forgotten.
Here's my answer to that, right? I once saw a fucking brilliant priest. So Morwenna, my wife, is not, in her opinion, Catholic anymore. But you wouldn't know that necessarily if you went around to our house, where she has a lot of Catholic iconography and stuff on the wall of her study. And in general, she likes going to Catholic churches and lighting candles and all that. She had a very, very quite hardcore Catholic upbringing and wanted to be a nun at one stage or whatever. And as a hangover from that, we still occasionally go to church. Like we went once on midnight mass at Christmas before we had kids. And I saw this amazing priest in a tiny church in Cornwall say this thing. He said, the way you have to think about Jesus is that he didn't know he was God. It's much like in The Others or The Sixth Sense, where the dead don't know that they're dead. Right? Yeah. He didn't know he was God. The divine part of him, this guy said, was his unconscious. So he had like a divine unconscious. So God's in his unconscious. But he doesn't himself know that he's God. He's just doing the godly stuff because his unconscious is pushing him towards it. So therefore, he doesn't know consciously that he's going to come back and he's going to live in heaven. It's all going to be fine. And therefore, you're wrong. It's not.
But that's all right. Then he's a man again, but that's okay. But then, you know, he's trying to reform the Jewish religion. So he's clearly not trying to set up his own religion. And, you know, and well, then we get back onto Jews don't count. But you know what? If he had any sense of godliness, why didn't he foresee what was going to happen to his people? But also, why didn't he foresee the problem with the Eucharist? You know, so it's all.
He didn't foresee a lot of it. But then, you know, if it wasn't in his conscious, but here's another thing which is similar to that in a way. It's another bit that I think I should put that in the book. And in terms of you think it should be a bit longer, I could have put this bit in. I might write a second edition. In which I put these bits in, but then the people who bought the first edition always get pissed off. They don't have to buy this for these new chapters. But anyway, here's a chapter I should have put in, because I went to Singapore on my way back from the Far East quite recently, and I went to a Buddhist temple. And something you may know is that Buddha does not describe himself. He consciously does not describe himself as a god and says, don't worship me as a god. Just listen to what I'm saying and blah, blah, blah. And I was in this temple, and it's four floors of absolute worship. In fact, at the centre of it, in a very Jesus-y way, there's a relic. I think it's Buddha's teeth, rather like you see Jesus' foreskin all over the place, or bits of the true cross, or whatever else it might be. And this is his teeth in a massive, great golden glass thing with like behind glass, and you're only allowed to stand there for a certain whatever. And so what I would suggest in terms of my book is that I am right, that the need to worship and to revere in a sort of supernatural way is hardwired into humanity. Even if the bloke says, look, don't do this about me. I'm just a man. I'm just saying some stuff. Take it or leave it. The next thing you know, there's a four-floor temple to him with his teeth in a window.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. It is, you know, but the book I'm talking about next week is about emotions, and yeah, I mean, I think the way we are, that we're so sort of slaves to our emotions, and that we can be manipulated, and we love being in groups, and that's, you know, and we love being in a group of people who agree with us, and that's what really, you know, that's the good and bad of religion, in essence, people should be, there's no, you know, I think with, I was sort of trying to persuade my parents not to be Christians. You kind of think, well, what, they're not doing any harm. Being Christians, it's like someone trying to persuade someone who wants to have an abortion not to have an abortion because you're religious. It's up to them whether they have an abortion or not. You might not like it, but it's up to them. And it's the same thing in reverse, I think, that sometimes atheists want to kind of say, well, you're not allowed to think that. Whereas all the points you make about, which obviously come from the play you wrote as well, but about how physics, you know, that we don't know what dark matter is. But we don't know what, you know, what we know about the universe is incredible. But, you know, we don't know most stuff. And we might be looking at the universe from a point of view of like a bacteria trying to understand where it is. It would have an understanding of its environment, but it couldn't possibly comprehend what everything was for,
I think this is a ticklish area for me, though, because as you know, the thing I'm most obsessed with is truth. And so I sort of feel the same urge a little bit, the Dawkins urge, you might call it, to say, no, but this is the truth. The truth is there is no God, and stop believing this other stuff. But I also have this other part of me that understands why people believe it and why it's wrapped up with their identity. So I'm not like Dawkins in the end. I think there's one bit which shows exactly how I feel, where I say, you know, that people who dismiss religion as fairy tale are, you know, that's wrong, because to dismiss fairy tale as fairy tale is wrong, because fairy tales tell us an enormous amount about what it means to be human. So to have no intellectual curiosity about religion is what I don't agree with.
Yeah.
However, I am with Richard Dawkins in basically thinking it is not true, and therefore, obviously, your parents, who are Church of England and lovely people who go to church or whatever, are a very benign version of people who might believe something that's not true, and that's fine. But obviously, there are other versions of this. David Koresh, whatever else it might be. You know, very extreme forms of religion oppressing other religion or leading to violence, whatever, where the desperation of the belief, which is what I'm talking about, the God desire, does lead to murderous consequences. So it can be benign, believing in a God, and it can also not be benign.
But that's true of atheism as well, and true of everything as well. So everything can have that element. You still don't necessarily have to wipe it out. But,
Sorry, all I was going to say, yes. I think it's worse now when you say everything. I think it's worse now. I think religion is an example of it, and I think it's worse now. I think we have created a technology whereby everyone can have their own reality.
Yeah.
And that's fine, actually. That would be fine if it wasn't for the fact that if everyone's reality gets questioned, they then get furious and shouty, and their way of believing in their own reality is to say, my reality is right and your reality is wrong and everyone is right, and blah, blah, blah. And that's fragmented now, so you get an incredibly shouty public space, Twitter, but in general, where people have to, I talked about this in a documentary I did about social media, which is, I believe that unfortunately people have to set up their sense of their own identity and their reality in opposition. Like the best way to have a sense of this is who I am is sadly not to just think this is who I am and that's fine. It's like, this is who I am, and I have to define that by saying this is who I'm not. And you're a cunt for being not me. And that's the unfortunate thing. And obviously religion is one example, but yeah, there are loads of other examples.
There are, but then also in the book you talk about you and Frank Skinner, obviously, who are very good friends and have got together and been friends for many years. And he's a very devout Catholic who genuinely believes he might go to hell as a result of being divorced. And you can't. I mean, I can't envisage a God that would do that to Frank. There's lots of things I would send Frank Skinner to hell for, but not getting divorced. But you can still have a discussion about it and an understanding of where you're coming
from. Can I just clarify that? Because it is sort of clarified in the book, but I'm not sure, certainly if your listeners will understand, but it's worth thinking about, is Frank didn't just think he would go to hell for being divorced. It took him a long time to explain, and there is a comedy element to it, because we'd just done a gig for Amnesty International, it was in the 90s. I didn't really know Frank at that time. I just got friendly with him. I tell you what, it's the same event, you'll like this, where I was starting, Newman and Badia were starting to come apart. And we'd been given the copy for our first stand-up video, Newman and Badia at this Shaftesbury Theatre, which was originally called Badia and Newman at the Shaftesbury Theatre. And Frank says he remembers Rob Newman getting the copy and changing Badil and Newman, chopping it out and writing Newman and Badil on all the copy for that video. Anyway, after that slightly hellish experience, he gave me a lift from wherever that gig was to the station. And he drove me there, and it was very foggy and a bit kind of creepy. And he started telling me this thing about how, because he was divorced and sleeping with his girlfriend, that's the key thing,
right?
That he was therefore committing adultery, because the Catholic Church don't recognise divorce. And while he was committing adultery, he couldn't go to confession, because you have to say when you go to confession and confess your sin, I won't do it again, to get absolution, right?
Yes.
Well, I'll do it again. So he would have to say, basically, I won't sleep with my girlfriend anymore in order to get absolution. And that would have been a problem for him and his girlfriend at the time. So he couldn't get confession or absolution, so he couldn't take communion.
Yeah.
That's the point at which I said, sorry, what? Why are you talking about all this? And he said, no, you don't understand. I think I will burn in hellfire because of this. And meant it very seriously. And to come back to what you were saying, it is true what I say in the book, which is I did not think, what an idiot. I thought, how brilliant. How brilliant that this obviously really clever bloke thinks something so, at some level, mad, from my point of view. Feels mad to think that. But there's something, what that does, it adds to the joy and, oh, I think the word is the gaiety of nations. What I mean is to the texture of life, to the character of things. You know, it's interesting that he believes that. That's what I thought.
Yeah, and like you say, you know, whatever you believe, we're not going to get it right. I mean, I think the thing with religion for me is you can look back and see how, if you study how religions were created, and you look back at Christianity and Judaism, you see how different it was through the different texts. So you can see that the actual religion is man-made, but it doesn't preclude the idea that there was something or someone that made a conscious decision to start what we have. It doesn't mean that they're watching. I mean, that's what I find. It just seems a lot of work for the person who created the universe to go, oh, and now what? Now I have to watch and make sure they're not fucking someone else. Yeah. What? I didn't realize it'd be all that, a lot of admin.
Yeah, that's an awful lot of admin, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, because apart from anything, if Frank had said, well, tell you what, I can't get back with my wife, but I just won't have sex with my present girlfriend. How is God going to monitor that?
And how's he going to go, yeah, that's fine. Oh, that's fine. That's all right. Like, I've got other people to deal with.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
It's a really interesting subject, and I've always been fascinated. And I think as a comedian, it's rich for comedy just because it's so illogical, but so emotional. As you say, you know, I love the stuff you do talking about physics, because I've tried to understand all the hard physics stuff. I mean, it just sounds, as you say, it just starts to sound like its own crazy religion where we're the shadows of something in the ninth dimension. You gotta go.
I only came by because I've thought a lot about quantum physics, because you say I wrote a play called God's Daughter, which is about religion and quantum physics. It's about a deeply believing young woman who thinks she can prove the actuality of miracles using physics and using equations. That's what that play is about. And I came to that partly by reading all these books, of which there are now a huge market, and I'm sure you read them, because I think blokes of our age and type do.
Yeah.
And I noticed that they were all called things like Underneath the Real and, you know, What Exists Beneath and things like that. And I thought, these sound like religious books to me, these titles, because we see through a glass darkly, do we not? You know, and then the truth is revealed to us. And that's like, that type of physics has a very similar attitude, I would say.
Yeah. Well, something's going on, isn't it, Dave? Something's going on.
It's quite the old world, Richard.
It'd be interesting to know what it was. I think the interesting thing is, and maybe this is, we're the only animal we know of, the only creature we know of that's aware of its own death and, you know, is aware that there's anything else going on. And maybe that is a sort of madness. I'm not going to say supposed to, because there's no supposed to, but you know, we're not supposed to know we're going to die. Let's say that.
No, I agree with that.
Yeah.
I mean, as I say, I use that very early on. It's quite a lot about animals in the book. And you know, I do believe that being the only animal that is aware of its own death is why we're also the only animal that has a God. As great as the name of God. Now, you might say, well, cats can't speak, but they couldn't come up with it. But animals do have all sorts of means of communication, especially primates have all sorts, and dolphins have all sorts of means of communication. But it seems to be mainly about how do we have sex and how do we find some fish or bananas, in the case of monkeys. And they haven't bothered with, oh, and how do we perpetuate our lives after we die? How about that? Or should we talk about that in our dolphin speech? No, they don't do that because they don't know that. So it seems to me to be a very early thing, as far as I can make out, from the growth of language and understanding and death as a thing that we know that we experience, that led to the consequent creation of a thing that outsmarts that, which is God.
Yeah. I would say when I had my general anaesthetic for my operation, it was I know I was on morphine. But it was very peaceful, and it felt like slipping away and dying, and it made me a lot less scared about dying.
Because I just thought,
this is it. I'm you disappear, and that's okay.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I always think, because a few people have said this to me about anaesthetic, because I talk about how we all, I think, however religious we are, we all know something, which is what our life, whatever consciousness was like before we were born, right? That it was absolute nothingness.
Yeah.
And that we therefore, I think we all know that that's what we're going back to. And a few people have said, yeah, but I had an anesthetic and, you know, it was kind of great and I was nice and I was relaxed. And I always say, and when did you have that thought? And they say, well, when I woke up. I think, yeah, that's the difference.
Yeah, but it was nice as you go. I didn't mind if I hadn't woken up. There was an hour of my life that disappeared and I wasn't there and there wasn't a soul sitting in the corner going, oh, well, we're off we go. It was just, I was gone. Yeah. And I found it quite reassuring. I still don't want to die, but I still also don't want to live for all fucking eternity. Yeah. There's a cutoff point somewhere in between.
So that's another thing people say to me, well, you know, you're saying this, but you're frightened of death. Would you want to live forever? No, of course I wouldn't want to live forever. It would get shit. But that doesn't mean that the creation of a desire to outsmart something you're frightened of, i.e. death, is going to have a logic in it. You're like, oh, actually, no, let's not create God and heaven because we'll get bored. No, that's not how the creation of myth works.
It's true. Another bit that I want to read out from one of the reviews. This is from the Telegraph guy that I presume might be the same one you're talking about.
He's the one who took a very lofty approach to it. He also says, Badil is very funny, as if that's like, you know, we know that. That doesn't matter. What does that matter?
But this is interesting about, you know, about a religious person's point of view or a different person's point of view. And that's what I like about this book, that it throws up like loads of opinions and some of them are crazy. If I had the author's certainty in a godless universe, I wouldn't waste my time writing books, let alone reviewing them. I might rob a bank.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah. It's like, yeah. What? So all that's stopping you robbing a bank is that you think God might be upset about it.
I did want to say, so you've heard of the police and the law courts, have you? You've heard of them, and you'd be in prison probably for quite a long time if you successfully robbed the bank. I mean, I suppose you might get away with it, and then you'd be on a desert island, but that would be the same for anyone whether they believed in God or not. Do you know what I mean? I don't think anyone doesn't rob a bank because of God. They don't rob a bank because they think they'll get caught and be put in prison.
Yeah.
But
it's funny, but it's interesting, you know, it does... it's a book that, because it's an opinion and it counters opinions, that the reviews are either very nice or people are quite angry with you.
Yeah, right.
Which I think for quite a reasonable book, it's quite odd that there's so many angry reviews. But I've experienced this when I tried to do my reasonable show about Jesus, I still got the angriness from that.
There's a review in the Jewish Chronicle by a guy called Rabbi Howard Cooper, who I think also didn't like Jews Don't Count, in which you just think, Howard, come on now, sit down, think about it. But anyway, his position is that I am enamoured of Christianity, which I thought was a really fabulous thought. And I didn't talk about Christianity quite a lot in the book, but actually what I'm saying about Christianity is that it services the God desire better than Judaism. That Jesus is a fabulous, I use the example of Hollywood screen manuals, that Hollywood screen manuals have this idea of what a hero should be. And it should be someone who's often from a lower class background, who sacrifices something to make you feel empathetic with them. That I talk about save the cat, this thing to save the cat. So early on in a film, they should do something nice so that you feel that they're good people. Jesus does all that shit. I mean, not a cat, but he helps a leper.
Lepers.
Yeah. And Judaism doesn't have anyone like that. It has, you know, Moses being really angry and, you know, going up with some tablets. It doesn't have a hero in Judah in the same way. And my point is, so therefore the God desire is serviced better by Jesus, who also offers eternal life through him, right? That doesn't make me enamored of Christianity. That makes me explaining my theory and why this religion works with my theory better than another one. But no, Rabbi Hal Cooper's furious about that. I think because he basically thinks, are you saying I'm in the wrong lane?
But that's when once you've made that decision to be absolutely in that lane, it's very hard to come out of it. And I completely understand it. And you would, when I did that sort of stupid thing where I did number plates, tried to do the number plates from 1 to 999, and I kind of started as a joke making up gods that were controlling the cars. But then it sort of started to, like, feel real, and then weird things would happen. You go, well, that, you know, you would... It almost you get to the point where you're so invested in your stupid idea that to step out of it would make you look even more stupid for having believed it in the first place. But I'm not saying that's all religion, but I think it's very difficult to, you know, because it's that comforting thing. It's, you know, there is, you don't get many deathbed conversions the other way, do you? So you don't get many people going, I believed in God, but fuck it, I'm about to die.
Yes, so
people stick with that.
You say that, I think Hugh Dennis told me that his dad, who was the Bishop of Ipswich, I want to say.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, Hugh.
Sorry, Hugh, if that's wrong. I'm calling him Hugh. His real name is Pete, but anyway. that his dad was the Bishop of Ipswich about a week before he died. Said to him, you know, Pete, all my life I've believed in God, and, you know, I hope I might be right. And clearly he was starting to doubt it as he approached the end, in a very Anglican, again, kind of benign way. So it is unusual, but you're right. Most of the time, it's atheists converting on their deathbed. And as I say in the book, that is not, despite the many people, religious people who think it is, an argument for the existence of God, but for the existence of fear.
Yeah.
That's what that is. And no doubt I, on my deathbed, will be praying, and I will know it's not true as I do it.
Yeah, you have to believe it, or God can see that you're lying as well, Dave. So there's no point in... He's clever enough to see through that.
So busy working out whether Frank Skinner, who's older than me, so it's unlikely, is still having sex with his girlfriend and not his wife, that he won't notice.
A few must slip through. There might just any system, there's going to be a few that slip through. Look, it's a really terrific book, as is Jews Don't Count, and I haven't read your kids' books, but I've read a couple of your other novels, which I've also enjoyed.
Have you not read them to your kids?
No, my daughter's is how old is she? Seven? Eight?
Yeah, well, that's all right.
Yeah, so she can start going in. She's reading, you know, Walliams.
No,
so she can read you.
I'm going to say it out loud. Mine are much funnier than Walliams.
I'd prefer her to read you than Walliams, I have to say. I don't like the idea of...
But you know what? You're in a position to affect that.
I can't say you're not allowed to read stuff.
No, but you can.
I can give you the books.
I believe I control the money. So here's the person controller by David Baddiel. Try this instead.
Okay, I'll give her some of your books, and I'm sure my son will enjoy them when he can effectively read. He's getting there. Are there any books that you're reading at the moment or have read recently, or a book or two that you would like to recommend that aren't your own?
Yes. So I'm reading late Graham Greene books at the moment. I started reading John le Carré recently, who I've never read before, but my wife is writing Slow Horses, which you might know if you watch that. It's really good.
No.
It's on Apple with Gary Oldman in it, and it's a sort of John le Carré, slightly comedy version of John le Carré, in that it's about a bunch of apparently shit spies who work for MI5, but who, in an underdog way, tend to, you know, sort of Scooby-Doo, in a way, sort of like manage to make things work for them. It's really good. It's really good. And I started reading John le Carré, some of whose work is very brilliant, Spy Who Came In From the Cold, and some of which I found Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, it's just like, oh, enough with the bureaucracy of MI5 or whatever. So that made me go back to Graham Greene, who is an author I've always really loved, because I haven't read a lot of his late books, which become very much about, you know, that. Possibly yeah. John le Carré. And he wrote a fantastic book called The Human Factor.
In 1978.
It's brilliant, which is a sort of John le Carré-like book about British spies. And I'm now reading The Honorary Consul by him, which is also totally brilliant. He was an anti-Semite as well, of course. But you know what? If I didn't read anti-Semites, I'd probably not read at all.
I read Graham Greene when I was a teenager and John le Carré. I haven't read either of them for a long time, so that's quite a good... not that I get any time to read books of dead people because I can't interview them. I've got to read a book a week. I can't do that. So it's hard. Unless you can... If you're wrong, I can talk to Graham Greene.
After you die.
Oh, I could die and then talk to Graham Greene, definitely. But I could maybe talk to him while I'm alive and broadcast it.
Yeah, although I think my religion quite holds with the whole ghost and seance thing
okay.
a bit. As much. But maybe. Call him up.
I'll try and get him on. You'll never know.
I think he's with Avalon, so he's very expensive.
Well, look, David, it's always lovely to talk to you, and I do recommend certainly. And as if you do a weekly podcast where you have to read a book a week, get David Baddiel on.
Yeah.
Sorry, David Baddiel on, because his books are really short. The audio book wasn't even 2 hours long. This podcast is almost as long as the book. It's absolutely brilliant for that. If that's where you're at. But also do by The God Desire by David Baddiel. We are back next week with Emotional Ignorance by Dr. Dean Burnett. Look, that's a book. Look at that. Look how big.
That is a good old thick
look
book.
At that.
Yeah.
I literally finished. I had to put it on double speed for the last 45 minutes so I could get the last bit done in time to talk to him.
The voice sounds silly. It sounds like Donald Duck.
The guy reading it isn't Dean, is very slow, and I realised you could actually go up to... Usually I do 1.4.
Right.
And that's all right for most people. With this one, I went up to 2 and it sounded okay. And then I put it on 2.4 and it started sounding a bit.
If you had your bollock locked off, was there an element of that comedy thing where your voice went up? Or did that matter?
There wasn't, because the other one was the more masculine of the two. I think if the other one comes off,
you'll be at 1.5.
That might be. Love to talk, David. Hopefully see you very soon.
Thank you. What a pleasure.
Thank you
very much.
Bye-bye. Thanks to Chris Evans as well for all of his hard work.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more.
and is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.